Hello.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's time for another action-packed episode of the Tripod Podcast.
I just need everybody to know I'm doing spirit fingers right now. You can't see
Woo-hoo.
it.
Spare fingers. Jazz hands. So I'm looking at the information we received about our guest. And my first impression is she has an honest face. Oh my gosh. I hope she doesn't try to sell me a car because I totally would buy one from her.
Well, chances are we have not booked somebody that sells cars. I could be
A good
wrong.
chance. It's a good chance. It's good to know. Good to know. Jen Thornton is her name. Ooh. Jen Thornton is her name. Maybe we should call her Honest Jen. Should we call her on the podcast? Hello, Honest Jen. All right,
Might
I'm
throw
being
her off a smidge. I don't know,
in
since
my.
that is our own internal.
That's true. That's true. Let me go ahead and say something nice about her. From her, well, let me read her intro here. This is the intro of Honest Jen, Jen Thornton. And here it begins. Jennifer has developed her expertise in talent strategy and leadership professional development over her exciting 20-plus year career as an HR professional. She's led international teams across Greater China, Mexico, the UK, and the US to expand into new markets, managing franchise retailers, and developing key strategic relationships, all while exceeding business objectives and financial results. The rapid growth of her consulting firm, 304 Coaching, has been largely due to Jennifer's unconventional approach to building innovative workforce development solutions for companies who are facing breakthrough growth and accelerated hiring patterns. She is a sought-after business strategist, specializing in startups and large value-based organizations. She assists her clients in building talent strategies that complement their business strategies to ensure exponential growth. She lives in Texas with her family and rescues. In her free time, she enjoys reading, historic preservation, remodeling her lake home, and spending time with friends. And I'll also add, she has a very, very honest face. Ladies and gentlemen, introducing to some, presenting to others, Jen Thornton, right after this important message. You are listening to Tribe Pod, a podcast series of interviews of interest to the HR community. It is hosted by Courtney Lane, produced by Jim Stroud, sponsored by Proactive Talent, and enjoyed by you. Today's episode begins right after this.
On-demand recruiting is an hourly service that we offer where our recruiters work as an extension of your business, helping to fill your positions by finding top talent.
So on-demand recruiting is there to address issues in hiring when a company is experiencing a lot of growth, when they're having some seasonality changes where they may temporarily need to expand their recruiting team. You maybe have a new line of business or a space where you're expanding your business and you need to bring in specialty expertise to help fill those niche roles that your internal team may not yet be ramped up on.
Proactive Talent's on-demand recruiting solution is quite different from a lot of the other models that you're going to see in the workplace. Whereas you're going to pay a contingency recruiting firm, typically on average around 20%, sometimes up to 30% of the first year salary of the person that you hire. And in that same period of time, you'll spend less than a quarter of that with Proactive Talent's managed on-demand.
For more information on Proactive Talent, visit them online at proactivetalent.com or click the link in the podcast description.
Well, hello everyone and welcome. Today I am joined by Jen Thornton, who is a talent strategy and leadership development expert with over 20 years of global experience helping teams scale with her innovative workforce development solutions. Welcome, Jen. We're so excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So just to get things started, why don't you share a little intro about yourself? I mean, how did you get into the field that you're in? What is it that sort of makes you passionate about it?
So my background is in HR, and the early part of my career, I was in the operations side of the business. It was actually all in the retail industry. And so I did the operation for years and years. And what I discovered and others discovered about me was I was able to get my results because I was very passionate about the team I assembled, the people I brought on, and how they worked together. And over time, I became looked at as someone who was really focused on that. And so, about 15 years ago, maybe, I decided I wanted to transition into HR from operations. So I actually created a business case on why we needed to have recruiters in the field and presented it and got people to buy off on my crazy idea. And that's how I became a recruiter, which was my first job in HR. And from there, I floated around to all different types of positions. And then the last several years of my corporate career, I was actually the head of international HR for a big retailer, and got to live in Hong Kong and London and Mexico, which is fantastic. And I think that's where I found my passion for talent strategies. I really saw how, organizations or teams that were passionate about the talent strategy and thinking about how it connected to the business strategy, those organizations did better. Those organizations or those groups were able to get, their ideas off the ground faster. And, I woke up one day and decided that I, wanted to get off the airplanes and, I just wanted to do that full time. I didn't want to do anything else. And so I created my own business, 304 Coaching. And that's what we do today, is we really help organizations think about their business and where it's going and what does that mean for the team and how do we strategize and make sure that our team is ready for our future growth.
That's awesome. I love it. Well, first of all, I always love to hear the stories of how I got into recruiting, because nobody ever grew up wanting to be a recruiter. We all sort of wandered our way there. So I always love hearing that story. And I love that it starts in the retail space, because I worked in the restaurant and hospitality space, and I think there's a lot of sort of, those are kissing cousins when it comes to sort of how organizations are structured and all of that. And I think back to like the leadership development programs and sort of talent approaches, like field recruiting and things like that, that I saw in the retail and restaurant space were oftentimes actually better than what I would see in like the traditional corporate setting. Somehow in that space, they really grabbed onto it. And do you see that too? Did you see sort of, as you started to shift into more traditional corporate settings, that there was maybe a little bit more buy-in that had to be done to get sort of those development mindsets in place?
You're absolutely right. And I did see that. And I think, I love that question. I think back of, why is that? I'm always curious, why is that? And I think that when you're in hospitality or you're in restaurant management or you're in retail management, all of those, we started at a very young age leading people. And so it's that's just what we do. I mean, I was making hiring decisions, and I still can't believe this, at like 19 and 20 years old. Right. I have sales associate. And I think that if you grow up in a corporate environment and you're an individual contributor, and then maybe you're a manager, you don't grow up leading people from kind of day one. And so I think it's harder for them to see that value or maybe connect with it, where, you and I grew up where, we were making decisions at a really early time in our career, and we just can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I ever, like, as you were talking, was probably the first time I was really like sitting there going, wait a minute, like, why do I feel like that I was better equipped coming out of that space to sort of lead or even be able to speak to others about leading than maybe my counterparts who were on the fast track of leadership development programs in corporate. And I'm like, well, maybe not the same speed there. So, are there other things that you see when you are talking to leaders who are trying to develop their teams and they're struggling? It's not simply that they didn't get to sort of, cut their teeth on it at a younger age. There have to be some other sort of keystones, I would think, that are like, this is typically where people are struggling, or this is typically why people are struggling. Do those trends exist? Are there sort of common reasons why people struggle to know how to build a team?
There are. There's a lot of different reasons, but when I boil it down to one thing, most people don't start a company because I want to create an amazing group of people that are just going to work awesome together, because that's not a business. You know, a business is, I have this technology idea, I have this widget I want to make, I have this service I want to create. And you're focused on that because that's what your expertise is. Then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I have to build a team to make all of this come true. And so it's not why people start a business. It isn't because they want to assemble an amazing team just to see what they might do as a group. They do it for different reasons. So talent strategies is just not their expertise.
Yeah. Do you find that people who are new leaders are easier to sort of mold and help them pick up some of the skills that you coach on? I sort of think of, you know, hard to teach an old dog new tricks. And, you know, just because you've been a leader for 20 years doesn't mean you've always been or even currently are a great leader. So I would think that's hard. But I mean, for to a certain extent, teaching somebody from scratch is, you know, a challenge as well. Or is it sort of just like each person's different and everybody has sort of their own journey, really?
I think every person's unique and different, but I do find that very experienced, new and very experienced leaders do connect with our training because we have such a different approach. And it's not the same thing they've heard over and over again. It's not about, well, just be nice to people and they'll do a good job. And so because I'm very much focused on the neuroscience of the mind and how does the mind take in language and what are those chemical reactions as a leader you create in someone's mind? So are you pushing someone to their primitive brain, which, you know, physically shuts down their prefrontal cortex, which is where all the stuff you need to happen happens? And so because our approach is so different, I think very experienced leaders kind of sit up in their chair because they're like, oh, this is maybe something different. This may be very factual and not just anecdotal feel-good exercises. There is science behind our language and what that means for our teams and then how our teams go about our business and how does that impact our business.
So is it the CEO that's bringing you in? Is it HR that's bringing you in? I mean, who's the one that's raising the flag and calling for help when you're coming in and working with teams?
You know, it's one or the other, and sometimes they're both together. And I think that oftentimes, you know, I always say, don't call me when you need me. Call me right before that.
Right.
Because it's a lot harder to unwind things than it is to build from scratch. But oftentimes I get phone calls when people are, you know, earlier in, you know, their infancy as an organization, and because they want to create an amazing culture and they are already starting to see the need for talent strategies and development. And then I work with a lot of very traditional large scale organizations. And with those organizations, oftentimes it may be HR or a sales executive. I get a lot of calls from sales leaders that are like, hey, you know, we need to make sure our sales team is as healthy as they can be. And let's talk about that. Again, especially because it's a different approach. And so, you know, when you start to learn about how to change your language, to change the chemicals and how people are using their mind, those are great sales techniques in there too. And so sometimes I get calls for them, but it just really depends. I always love it when I get the call from the leaders themselves, because it means they're completely invested in it and they see the opportunity for change and they're ready for it.
So you talk about like the neuroscience and the way that our language sort of creates chemical reactions and changes things. That's a little bit different than the traditional sort of talent management approach for a lot of organizations. How did you find yourself going down that path of really looking at it from much more of a sort of biological perspective?
You know, it was by accident, actually, which is always sometimes the best things. I'm a lifetime learner. I'm a junkie for any kind of education type courses. I have a commitment to myself that I do some type of course every single year of my life. And several years ago, I found a course called Conversation Intelligence, led by an amazing woman, Judith Glacier. And she had spent 40 years studying the neuroscience of the brain how it responded to conversations, and what was the impact on business results. And she was certifying practitioners in, you know, her program. And I was like, that sounds cool and interesting and different. I'm going to jump on that. And I was hooked from day one. And, you know, Judith was an amazing woman. Unfortunately, we lost her about a year and a half ago. But I feel she changed my life. She taught me so much. And I get to carry on her legacy and all those years of work that she did. Still lives on today through all of us who, you know, have gone through her program and understand her program. And then from there, it just opened up this whole new world for me, and I've gotten really nerdy about it. And I love to read stuff about the brain. But man, when you understand that your frustration is really things that are just chemical reactions, and you can actually change your relationships by just changing your language. You can still tell the truth. Actually, you can get even more honest. You can still tell the truth. You can, you know, still demand excellence. You can do everything you want to do, but you can just change your language and, you know, in a way in which it helps people open up the right parts of their mind.
And I feel like for a lot of folks, when you've got sort of that scientific aspect to it, it makes it easier to grab onto or trust the process, maybe is the better way to put it, because it, you know, oftentimes we can go through programs and it does feel a little too anecdotal, or it does feel a little too fluffy or soft around the edges. And you're like, this sounds great in theory, but oh, I mean, really? And so I would have to imagine that when you've got that, you know, really scientific, you know, lens on it, it helps people to say, okay, well, you know, there's data to support that this actually makes a difference. I have something to like lean back on to trust that if I commit to sort of doing these activities and making these changes, I'm going to start to see results.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It does do that. And it not only helps them at work, but it starts to help them in all kinds of relationships. And I think that's also a big piece of it. They start to understand why certain people push their buttons. You know, what's interesting is our brain, you know, our brain has one job, and that's to keep us alive. And it does that through fear. And it does that by alerting us about trouble. But your brain doesn't really understand trouble between, uh-oh, there's a snake around my leg, or uh-oh, that scary executive is walking down the hall, what is he or she going to say to me? Your brain doesn't really know the difference between those two. And so when we get within 10 feet of someone, our brains and our chemicals start responding based on our history with that person. If we've always had a really good relationship with them, all this feel good stuff, dopamine starts going off and everything's good. If the last couple of conversations have been tough, we're scared that they're going to judge us, we're scared that they're going to think that we're not good, then your brain kicks off fear and cortisol. And so before that person even has a chance to say hello as you pass them in the hall, your body is responding and telling you something unconsciously, which then, of course, influences how we feel about that person.
I had never really thought about it. And so I have to ask though, is 10 feet, is that an actual, like, sort of, there's evidence to show that 10 feet is the moment where your body's like, ding, there's this person.
There's actual research that shows like how fast you start to respond. But then you have to think about, well, in our virtual world, what does that mean? And, you know, I haven't seen any studies on that yet, but I'm sure they'll be coming out, because why would we not be studying all this virtual stuff that we're all learning? But, you know, I think, you know, I can think of my own self. If I look at my calendar that day and I look at everyone I'm going to talk to, I can say, okay, at 9 o'clock, you know, I'm going to do this. Oh, I'm really excited. You know, that's my favorite client. Oh my gosh, at 1 o'clock, I have a podcast. I hope it goes well. You know, like you start to kind of feel, and if you look at your calendar and it's full of meetings you're excited about, you're in a good mood. If it's meetings that you're like, oh gosh, did I get that prepared? I have to present. Are they going to like me? Then you have stress chemicals going off. And so it would be interesting to see about how that research will play out over time.
Yeah, I think that will be very interesting, because I know everybody's trying to figure out now in this new space, it has put everything really on its head. Even for those of us who, you know, have been remote for a long time, it's still just change things. Like somehow not having the option to go and be somewhere has made being remote feel differently, even though I've been doing it for a few years now. So on that, I'm wondering, are you, so, you know, the, the pandemic has had a huge impact on the workforce, and a lot of companies had to make some really difficult decisions and cut back their teams and ask their teams to do more than they've ever asked them to do before. And I'm wondering, have you seen, based on the conversations you're hearing and things like that, or maybe who's reaching out to you, at the same time, are company leaders having to sort of reconcile with the fact that they maybe haven't been doing the work to prepare their teams to be ready to sort of step up and perform at a higher level than they've probably had to before this year?
I'm seeing a lot of trends that relate to that. One of the trends I'm seeing is that when we had to crisis manage at the early of 2020, you know, crisis management has its place. Building is on fire, get out. There's no discussion. There's no ifs, ands, buts. Right. What I say, get out, the building's on fire. And that's crisis management. Well, crisis management only works in a crisis. But what I'm seeing is because we were having to do so much of that, you know, constant, like, no, do this, no, do that, no, do this, no, do that. And we were moving so quickly to respond that we've gotten into some bad habits. And we're crisis managing when things are not a crisis, and that it can feel very, you know, it's very stern, it's very direct, there's no discussion, it brings a ton of fear into the mind, which, you know, obviously an issue. And the other thing that I'm seeing, which I find really interesting for leaders, is they have to, they're struggling with how to attach results to perform and performance. So we used to say, well, you sat in your chair for 40 hours and I see you in your chair for 40 hours, so you're a good performer. Well, now what if I can't see you in that chair? And what if you're still doing the exact same thing you're doing, but maybe you're doing it in a flex schedule? You work from 5 to 8 a.m. and then 7 to 10 p.m., but you're actually maybe even getting more done. So I'm seeing leaders really struggle with how to say, yes, you did your job, because they can't count hours in the seat anymore. And I think that's going to be a trend, is how do we evaluate performance? Do we do it by the hours worked, or do we do it by here are your objectives as a full-time employee and I expect them done? So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Well, and I think for a long time there are folks, I mean, I know certainly for me, before I moved into a remote space that, and I was in a more traditional corporate settings, that was kind of this push and pull between employees and leaders of, you shouldn't have to see me to know that my work is getting done. There's like this loss of trust. There's this sense that somehow if I'm really effective at my job and I do a good job of getting it done in 7 hours that day instead of 8 hours, it's still less valuable than if I sat there for 8 hours. And so I think it is forced those conversations to sort of bubble up to the top and people be willing to talk about it, because you're right. If I'm not going to sit on Zoom all day and let you watch me work, that's not efficient or effective for anyone. But you know,
kind of creepy.
It's incredibly creepy. But at the same time, you know, people have to sort of buy into that level of trust with each other, that you're going to trust me to get my work done and you can trust me to get my work done. I'm going to meet that expectation. But I know there are leaders, you know, that I've worked with in the past, not directly over me necessarily, but just in general, that they have to be struggling right now because they relied so heavily on seeing people in their seats to decide who the high performer was or who the most valuable player was on their team.
Yeah. And I know people, you know, someone will be like, oh, that person, they're always working late. They're so committed. Yeah. And I'm like, and the person who left, you know, an hour early isn't committed. I'm like, well, that person who left an hour early actually got more done today than that person who's still sitting there. But again, our traditional way of looking at work is by the hour and not by the output. And when you start giving credit by output and paying by output, it really changes how you look at performance and may even change who you feel like is a top performer on your team.
Do you think we're going to see a big shift in how, like, as this starts to play out, like, are the traditional sort of performance management, performance reviews going to finally, and I say finally on purpose, finally get tossed out the window, and we're going to be willing to, you know, more people adopt sort of that continuous conversation around development and performance? Are we on, is this going to push us in the right trajectory?
I hope so. I really hope so. But you know, I think it will take a while, because I think that traditional performance reviews are put in place because it allows people to be, quite frankly, a little lazy throughout the year. And so those are like those check-ins that says, no matter what, the whole entire company has to do this by this date. And I know when I was in HR, I still had to chase everyone to make sure they did it by that date. Mm-hmm. And so when you take away your, I guess, your safety net, and people are expected to be great leaders and perform without a due date, you know, it's scary. But then you also have to say, well, if I take away your due dates and I take away this management, then maybe you'll see who your top performers are, and maybe you'll look at them completely different. And so I think organizations, again, it's about what does performance look like, and how, what do you want it to be? Get really crystal clear on the work and what good looks like, and then figure out how will that get done, I guess, in the future. But you know, I think there's a lot changing, and 2020 will change a lot in everyone's lives. And I think way of work is, you know, on that list. I mean, there's nothing that's not on that list. But I think, you know, we look back 5 and 10 years from now, and we dissect, you know, the long-term effect of everything, it'll be very interesting.
Yeah. So I know from, you know, your expertise and your background, while you work heavily in the leadership development side, you also help teams on the front end side of it, the hiring side, as they're trying to prepare to bring people into their teams. So would love to chat and sort of pick your brain around that a little bit, because I'm wondering, as you're talking about the science of things, how does that get applied on the hiring piece? Like, how are we talking about it on the front end of the funnel before the person even becomes an employee?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because that is like, if someone will give me a soapbox, I'm going to get on. I'm going to talk about, before you make a hiring decision, get clear on the work. And when I mean get clear on the work, I always say people throw payroll at problems. They'll see like two people just overwhelmed. And so they're like, oh, we'll just hire someone over there. But they don't stop and say, well, are they overwhelmed because our workflow's wrong? Are they overwhelmed because we haven't trained them well? Are they overwhelmed because they work for a disorganized supervisor, and they'd be just fine if that supervisor was organized? And so you first have to get really clear on why. And then if it is actual physical work, then decide, you know, well, is this work, you know, required? When I look and help people think about work, I always say, what's mission critical, which impacts the bottom line? You know, what's a nice to do, you know, what's the right thing to do, and then what's vanity work? And we do a ton of vanity work. It makes me crazy. And vanity work is something that, I remember one company I worked with, they had this new system that produced all their reports, and they had automated a ton of stuff, and it was saving a ton of time. But the CEO didn't like those reports, didn't like the way they looked. And so after they ran the report, which they could physically just lay on the CEO's desk, they spent hours, multiple people hours, printing the information that he needed, reorganizing it in a way he liked, and then handing it to him. Well, that's the kind of vanity work that happens all of the time, because someone likes it or someone doesn't like it. And that's the stuff you have to get honest with. And so then, you know, once you get honest with the work and then really decide, is this full-time, part-time, a contractor, and then start to work on the job description, work on the specs, like do all the stuff you're supposed to do, but don't start it until you've gotten clear on the work. Because when you bring people in, they need to be clear on the job you want them to do. And then again, be clear on what performance looks like.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious around that piece, because so the HR Technology Conference is going on this week, and it's virtual, of course. And, you know, Josh Berson opened up with the keynote, and he was talking about how, you know, they're starting to see more and more behind this trend of organizations moving away from the traditional hierarchical approach to, you know, sort of a matrix of jobs and layers and all of that. And really because of the pandemic being forced into this much more agile, fluid space. So as you're talking about, you know, being really clear on the work, I mean, I would have to imagine there still has to be that percentage of flexibility in it too. And like understanding that, like, if anything this year, we've learned that we all have to be willing to wear different hats every once in a while and sort of pitch in. Do you see a space for that too in this approach?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And even getting clear on the work, you know, is about being flexible, because when times are good, then you may be doing these 15 things. If you have to strap back, then it comes down to these 10 things. If it's really tough, it's these 8 things, but then you can flex back up to maybe 20 things. But, you know, you have to think about that flex. The other trend that I think is really important to notice, and some leaders do a better job at as others, is bringing experts in for projects. And so if you have a really good team and they're doing really good things and you want to do a special project, instead of hiring more people or stressing your team out that because they're not really actually that good at it, bring an expert in for a short period of time to partner with your teams. They can transfer knowledge. They can help you get maybe some processes, whatever you need them for. And then, you know, it's a short-term project. And I think we're going to see a lot more people bringing people in for short-term projects versus these, you know, hiring a million people to kind of just hope all the work gets done.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that sort of, you know, marketplace of talent and the sort of gig economy is going to start showing up more and more in the corporate space, where people are taking advantage of the expert when they need the expert for the amount of time that they need that expertise there. And then being okay with, you know, letting the person go back off into the next thing that they're doing. I think traditionally there's sort of been this sort of territorial thing where if we didn't create it in-house, if we didn't build it in-house and have only our fingerprints on it, somehow it wasn't authentic to us, or somehow it wasn't actually our work. So I think, I hope, and I think we are going to start to see more trends around that.
Yeah. And I'm getting a lot of calls this year in particular from very large companies who have, you know, good size HR departments and huge learning and development departments. But they were so focused on the core of the business that they just didn't have the space to do some of this other work, and brought me in to do projects. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then I came in for 4 months, and then I, you know, kind of bolted onto the team and executed, you know, took a lead on a specific project, got it done, got it rolled out. One project, in fact, I did 16 webinars around the world for a company. I know, but it was so much fun. And because they just didn't have the capabilities. So they could have either said, oh, we're not going to do this very much needed training, or we have to hire someone. Like, it was just, and it's just a different way of looking at it, is bring an expert in, let them do their expertise, and then we move on.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great route. And I think also there's this added value of that, the outsider's perspective. And again, I think that's some of the hesitancy, is you don't want to sort of open up the closet and let somebody who's not a part of, you know, the team see the skeletons or see, you know, how messy things may be. But oftentimes when you have somebody coming from the outside looking in, they're able to provide a different perspective that no matter how much you may want to, you would never have quite gotten there on your own, because you just, it's kind of like, I said this once in a conversation, I'm just going to stick with it forever. But it's kind of like, if you've got an ugly baby, like, you're never going to think your baby's ugly. But your baby may be ugly, and so somebody else may be able to look at your baby and go, yeah, I mean, it's not the most beautiful baby. There's some things we can do.
Much better in this outfit.
Yeah. Like, maybe not that color. Like, yeah. Let's just,
maybe
but, you know, but I do think that's true. I think we get very passionate and, you know, put a lot of ourselves in our work, and it's really hard to really step back and take an objective view of what we're doing and really understand how to even navigate forward, no matter how stuck we may feel like we are.
Yeah. And in the traditional corporate environment, a lot of the jobs people are expected to be really heavily a generalist, and there's a lot of value, because again, that speaks back to flexibility. But then there are times where you need to bring an expert in for a short period of time and not expect your generalists to be experts in so much, because I think sometimes we set people up for failure because we want them, we do a job description, which is polar opposite. It's basically two jobs merged as one, and they're completely different. And, you know, those unicorns, I used to always say when I was a recruiter, if only I had an easy bake oven and I could just put the job description in and the right candidate would come out, but it didn't work that way. That, you know, with the concept of being okay with experts, you're allowing people to be a generalist, you're setting them up for success, and then you're giving them the support where the organization needs it.
Yeah. And you're helping them actually learn and develop themselves, because they have a chance to sit down with somebody who has a deeper knowledge than they do, because they're specialized in an area, and they're able to, you know, grow from that and network and become connected with that person. And it just, you know, I think it has a longer tail positive impact going that route than I think a lot of times is just directly visible to people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It does.
So I've loved this conversation, but before we go, are there any last thoughts or things that, you know, takeaways that you would want to make sure that you share with our audience before we start to wrap up?
Oh gosh, that's always, I love those questions. I think especially right now in the world we live in today, where everything we knew is kind of not there anymore. I think it's a great time to get in the habit of learning every day. And, you know, one of the things I've practiced this year, and those who I see practice really have had some good insight. You know, at the end of the day, make sure you ask your team, what should I have learned today that maybe I didn't? What do you wish I would have said today that maybe I didn't? What do you wish I hadn't said? But just at the end of your day or throughout the day, just at some point, ask someone, what should I know that I don't know? What should I hear that I didn't hear? What should I learn that I don't know? And if you can do that once a day, just imagine in another year how much information you'll have and how different you may see the world.
I love that advice. That's awesome. Thank you. So if folks want to get in touch with you, Jen, and find out more about your consulting and coaching services and all of that that you offer, or just to sort of, you know, connect with you in general, what's the best way for them to do that?
So you can go to 304coaching.com and you can reach me through our website, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn at Jen Thornton, ACC.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been such a fun conversation. I've really enjoyed it. I have taken notes. I'm going to go and look some things up myself and continue my own learning. So I'm really excited about that. But thank you. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. And thanks to all of our listeners for being here with us today.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Wow, that was a nice podcast. You guys could have gone on for hours, I think.
I think we really could have. I think we could have. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed that a lot.
It was. I like in the beginning when she said how people stumble into recruiting, and I was thinking, oh, that's so true. No one has a career fair and says, when I grow up, I want to be a recruiter.
Not a one. I've yet to meet a one. I ask every person I know that is in recruiting, and I've yet to meet a one that has said that on career day when they were in sixth grade, they went in a recruiter costume. Which, what would that even look like?
I don't know. a frazzled look on their face.
I was just going to say frazzled. That was the word in my head. It was frazzled.
And I like how she said using language to control the conversation. I was like, man, I could have used that when I was dating in college. And you really want to go out for dinner with me.
I don't think she was talking about mind control. I think you need to go back and re-listen.
I could have used that.
I don't think she was talking about mind control. But I did love that she was talking about the science of conversation and how the words we use actually create a biological response. So maybe you could have used that.
Yes. I think we could have used that to combat some of the media stories.
Yeah. True.
Definitely use that. What were some of your highlights? What were your big takeaways?
You know, it was a really great conversation, but I loved at the very end, sort of her final parting thoughts when she talked about sort of the daily check-ins, like just committing a very easy and small habit. It's not like a heavy lift. It's just once a day, commit to checking in with someone about, you know, what you could be learning from them, what they're seeing or hearing, or what they know that maybe you don't know. And, you know, the idea, I think we a lot of times think about sort of like continuous learning being, you know, a bit more of an undertaking than that. I think she, that advice shares how you can just, in very small incremental ways, you know, start to absorb new information. Cause I loved how she said, just think if you started that today, a year from now, how much you would have gained and learned. And she's absolutely right. So I loved that. The nerd in me really loved that.
That is a good suggestion. And I think I'll check in with our listeners. Listeners, if you have any questions or comments about this episode of TribePod, by all means, send us an email. Our email address is TribePod, TribePod, just like it's spelled in the title of the podcast, TribePod@proactivetalent.com. We would so like to hear from you. So that being said, I think we'll wrap it up right here, Courtney.
Sounds great. You have a good rest of your afternoon, Jim.
And you as well. I'm going to go check in on some food right now.